How's it going?
Twice in 1 year. This is a treat.
That's right. Nice to talk again.
Oh my God, so happy to speak with you again, especially about, I mean, this is a big year for you. You had Bike Riders, Saturday Night, and Alien Romulus. Three totally different films.
I'm very lucky this year.
Oh my.
We're working on really amazing movies.
Well, and the thing is, each is so different than the other from not just from a story perspective, but sonically and the entire oral experience. With each one, I mean, as much as I love Saturday Night and your 40 different tracks of 1970s noise, it's still, my heart belongs to that one because of the vintage that you have in there. But now with Alien Romulus, wow. You and the rest of the team blew me out of the water with this one because the timing of this film is so crucial and specific, taking place between Alien in 79 and Aliens. So you've got to incorporate familiar sounds, but that would hearken to Alien, but also representing the future of what's coming in Aliens.
So thread the needle, if you will.
Yeah. And boy, you did a lot of needle threading here.
That's true. There was quite a bit.
Where do you even start? Because obviously, we have a lot of the requisite alien notions and sounds and concepts, and there is an expectation from the audience for certain sounds. But then you have to build on those for that futuristic sense after 1979. So where do you and the team even start with this once you get into editing and mixing and coming up with these very unique compilations of sound?
That's a good question. Well, I mean, you know, in terms of where did we begin, you know, basically, it actually began for us talking to Fede, and when we first went in to talk to him about whether or not we'd even all be working together on the project, it very quickly became not an interview and actually became a spotting session. So we started talking about, you know, how we all wanted to approach the film, and it became clear to us that he was, you know, a massive fan of the original films for all the same reasons we were, you know, even sonically, that he got it the way that, you know, we felt like we had come into it with an idea of how we wanted to approach it, which was really honoring the aesthetic of the first film, but then finding a way to bridge it to the second film as well. And he totally got that, and he totally got the idea of, like, texture and, you know, grit and not being too pretty sounding, and, you know, nothing too shiny, and everything sounds like it's been used and it's, you know, kind of on the verge of breaking all the time. And then, you know, to the point that he wanted it to sound like this was a very noisy world, and not, you know, not pretty and kind of oppressive. And so he wanted to know how he could help the actors sort of understand that, you know, they would need to be sort of yelling over a bunch of loud machinery all the time. And so what we did was, based on the conversations with him and some concept art that he sent us and reading the script, we started making sounds for these environments on the ship, you know, looking at all the different sets and coming up with sounds for each set. And then we sent those to the production sound mixer, and he actually played them on set to the actors really loud over these big speakers to give them this sense of what the energy level would be like in these scenes, so they would adjust their performance accordingly. So, you know, and also starting that early also gave us a chance to, you know, not only watch the first two films kind of obsessively and start trying to break down, you know, what exactly made them sound the way they did, but it gave us a lot of time to start doing research about how to recreate these sounds, because really there was very little we could lean on in terms of library sounds for this. So we had to just figure out, you know, essentially how to recreate these sounds, these signature sounds. For example, you know, all the sounds of the Xenomorph, the sound of the pulse rifle and things like that. sounds bigger and beefier, more concussive, but still has that essential character of the pulse rifle. How do we take the sounds of the Xenomorph and make them sound like they have more mass and they're bigger and you know, more more low end than the original films had? So it was a fun challenge to not only recreate all those sounds from the original film, but then extend that world a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love the fact that you have a base of legacy sounds.
Yeah, that was important.
Such as for Mother. And of course, the cadence, the sounds for Rook, wow. Yeah. You really honed in on the original Ash and really captured that.
As you can imagine, that took a lot of trial and error and a lot of experimentation. And even just to recreate Ian Holm's voice, we worked with his estate, to get permission to use his voice, of course. But then we had to go literally into the salt mines of the 20th Century Fox Film Archive that Disney now owns, and go into this archive, and they found the original tapes from set, the original production sound tapes, and so these are 40-something year old tapes, so they had to carefully digitize them without them falling apart, so that we could get enough material of his performance of Ash, because you can't just use Ian Holm's voice. You have to really, he was doing such a specific voice and such a specific performance that we wanted the AI model to understand what that version of Ian Holm was versus just Ian Holm as a generic actor. So that was a whole process, and then once we were able to use the AI model to recreate the performance, then it was about trying to figure out how to process the voice so that it sounded like Ash in the first film once he was broken. And so that was the whole exploratory process of me going on eBay and buying a bunch of old 70s sound equipment to try to figure out what they could have been using to make it sound that way 40 years ago. So that was a really fun process for me. It's, sort of almost like audio archaeology, trying to figure out what would have been available back then and how would they have used it to make it sound the way I hear. And it was a really fun challenge for me just as a sound designer and mixer to try to put my head in the head of the people that came before us and, figure out how they may have done something and make our version of it.
Did you try hunting down some of the original sound gurus on Alien or Aliens?
Well, unfortunately, most of them are gone now.
That's, yeah.
Because, these were largely guys that were, in their, they were seasoned professionals at that point, right? So it was long enough ago that most of those guys are no longer with us. So that was a bit of a dead end, and it wasn't very well documented in terms of, these days we have journalists like you who are, helping to preserve some of the process of how we do what we do, but back then that wasn't really a thing.
Yeah.
So there's very little documentation about it. There's very little, there's certainly no behind-the-scenes videos and things like that, so a lot of it was just trial and error and, trying to dig through the archives to find whatever sound material we could, but it was actually fairly poorly archived in that sense, the first film at least. The second film was better, but that first film, there's very little material available on the sound side, other than, like I said, those original tapes that we found.
Wow. And that's so sad. That is so sad.
It is sad, I have to say. It's one of those things that makes you realize how far we've come, as a industry.
Yeah.
And it's funny to think, back then the maybe the studios just didn't really understand how much value the films would have in the future, because home video didn't exist.
Right.
Streaming obviously didn't exist. The movie would come out and it would do what it did in the theater, and then that would kind of be it. It would just sit on a shelf and maybe they'd make a sequel, right? So I don't think they were paying as close attention to archiving all the little bits and pieces back then as they maybe should have been.
Yeah. Something that you do so well here with the editing and the mix is that you've got so many layers of sound here. So many layers of sound. And yet everything is blended together, but all of these sounds, it's like they get, you give each of them a moment in the sun to shine, such as the Corbelon takeoff and the docking, your gravity generators. I love the sound of that. The explosions, the echo probe. Okay, the face huggers, that is my favorite sound in the entire film. I'm going to tell you that right now. Those little claws clinking.
It sounds,
I'm sure it's like little crabs and lobsters, but by the same time, it could be a woman in a lot of women in stiletto heels. It's so distinctive.
Yeah, that's true.
But each one of these sounds, and of course, our legacy sounds of Mother and things, but and the launches. But you let each one of them have their moment in the sun. So I'm curious about your process in mixing all of these sounds, but letting each one have that moment to stand out. And then you buttress all of that and counter it with the most glorious, glorious silence. You know, in space, no one can hear you scream. We don't hear anything else either.
Right.
So you shock us sonically. So talk to me about your process for that, because with so much happening here, this could not have been easy.
It wasn't, but it was also one of those things that we really wanted to get right, because we felt that it was one, when we analyzed the original film, one of the things that we were really struck by was how focused the mix actually is. Even though the mix, it has this sort of feeling of being verite and being kind of almost documentary-like and kind of messy and noisy, but it also is very specific about, you know, what you're hearing from moment to moment. So, you know, when you hear Mother boot up, you hear, you know, not 30 sounds at once. You sort of hear a series of kind of interesting and weird sounds that are, like, you know, in series rather than in parallel, if you will. And so that was something that we really wanted to embrace as an aesthetic choice in our mix, just, you know, right off the bat. So, and you know, to be fair, that is something that I'm always striving to do, is try to, you know, keep the mix uncluttered and keep the mix dynamic and focused. But in this film, it felt like a particularly important aspect, because it's one of the things that we felt made the original film sound like the original film, you know, sound the way it did, sound memorable, is the, you know, not only using interesting sounds, using unexpected sounds, but also making room in the mix for the audience to really pay attention to those sounds and enjoy those sounds. So that was something that we set out to do right off the bat.
And then you've got to throw the score, Benjamin's score, in here. And the score is really important in this film.
It's
in tandem with the sonic elements, with these distinct sounds.
Yep.
There are times where the rhythm of the score plays against the rhythm of the elements within the ship. And I found it really interesting the way you mix that. What were your thoughts in that approach for that juxtaposition, that contrasting mix?
Well, that was, again, that was something that it certainly didn't happen by accident. We spent a lot of time working with, you know, Ben and his amazing music editor, you know, experimenting, and, you know, it was really a process of trying to, you know, how should I say this? Like, it was a give and take on each side of music and sound effects, where there was moments when we thought, okay, well, let's move these sound effects so they'll be in a sort of pleasing rhythm with the music. Either, you know, it usually wasn't kind of on beat with the music, but it was sort of rubbing in an interesting way. And then there was other times when we moved the music to accommodate the sound design. So it was really a very, mutually beneficial relationship there, in a way that, you know, often I find with, you know, movies that use music and sound design fully, they sometimes can almost step on top of each other. And I'm always trying to figure out how can we avoid that and actually make the two complement each other to the point that you can hopefully not even pull them apart in your head sometimes. But what that takes is a composer and a music editor. Our music editor was Clint Bennett, who's amazing creatively as well. But a music editor and a composer who are willing to do that. You know, the thing that's so great about working with Ben, and I've worked with him on multiple projects like this, where he's not precious about us taking apart the music and putting it back together, which is a big testament to his faith in the process and his understanding of serving a director's vision rather than just serving your own creative vision, because he really does let us kind of go crazy. I mean, he'll usually come in and listen to what we've done and might have some ideas of how to make it more musical, but he actually really likes it when we, like, you know, hey, Ben, sorry, but, you know, we took out, you know, this whole part of the music so we could focus on this thing that you probably didn't even really intend to be the main thing. Like, for example, you know, the end scene with the Offspring, we really took it down to just this, like, pulsing element, and then we filled in the rest of it with this siren sound that we had made with sound design. And he was, you know, I was a little worried that he was going to be like, oh, I'm missing all the other stuff I wrote there, but of course, he was like, oh, that's brilliant. You know, this is so much better than whatever I had written here. So it just says a lot about, his willingness to collaborate on this whole sound process.
You know, I think one of the really interesting elements of what you've done sonically on Alien Romulus is the juxtaposition of silence and sound. And not just with the silence in space, but within the same scenes and sequences, we've got people in multiple situations where on one side of the door, it is like a cacophony of flooding and alarms and screaming and terror. And then they're viewing what's happening on the other side of the door, but can't hear it. Or it might be so muffled. How challenging is that development for you? Because there are numerous instances of that, and I was really impressed with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's something we spent a lot of time and effort on, to be honest. It's something that we wanted to really push contrast whenever possible. So, you know, sometimes that's loud to quiet, sometimes that's low to high, you know, in terms of frequency. You know, it was just trying to make big shifts between, you know, cuts and moments and scenes. And like I said, often that meant going to silence or near silence. You know, we were lucky that Fede is such a, you know, bold filmmaker and really, you know, embraced. We had this idea that let's try to make space as silent as we can. And he really embraced that idea to the point that he said, "Okay, let's take out all the sound in the very beginning shot. So you know you're seeing this big, you know, star field, and then a ship starts approaching in space, and it's silent. You know, and it's silent for like 30 seconds. And to the point that I think the audience starts getting a little nervous, almost a little unsettled. And then suddenly the probe turns on." And, you know, it's very loud again, right? So, although it's not even that loud, it just feels loud because we've been playing it silent. But the thing that was really clever about that is he was basically saying, look, if we play this whole first shot silent, we're setting the expectation for the audience that we are going to be doing this, that space is quiet, you know? And then... We decided pretty early on that if we literally played things silently, that was just not very cinematic. So we came up with this idea of, well, let's play it all super muffled and almost as if you're hearing it through your body rather than hearing it from your ears. So really bassy and really muffled. And that was great because it gave us, again, more contrast. So when we went out into space from inside, there was a big difference. And it wasn't exactly silent, but it was sort of like the impression of silence.
Mm-hmm. I just love that so much in this film, Will. Now, a big question I have for you is, you've got this great 1979 aesthetic that permeates the entire film. Fede does it visually, you and your team, you do it sonically, and you make that aesthetic work while upping the ante, bringing it up into, you know, future tech. But how do you keep that aesthetic and then convert this and then mix for Dolby Atmos? Because I heard it in the theater in Dolby, and I've watched it at home. This could not have been an easy task.
It wasn't. No, that's really true. I mean, you know, we did a lot of analysis on that original film, and you know, it's first of all, it's very old, but it's almost mono. I mean, it's not exactly mono, but it's certainly not like what we think of these days as being, you know, immersive in the sense of having a lot of 3D panning and that kind of thing. So the challenge was, you know, how do we take that aesthetic and expand it to a modern Dolby Atmos mix, you know, a modern immersive kind of mix that audiences have come to want, you know, and expect from a movie like this. So we played around a lot with essentially doing tape, you know, a tape style sound. So we found some software that would help us emulate the sound of tape saturation and tape distortion, and then we were able to apply that on all of our stems. So the dialogue, the music, the sound design, everything got the same treatment. So it all sounded as if we were mixing it on magnetic film like they would have back in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
but with just a lot more channels. So, you know, in Atmos, there's, you know, 128 possible channels.
Yep.
and we applied it to every single one of them.
So, oh, my God.
It was, if we would have done that, you know, in the actual analog realm, it would have taken, you know, like a football field size of recording machines. But, you know, luckily we're in the modern age working with Pro Tools, and the software to emulate tape, the sound of tape, it has come quite a long way. And, you know, maybe it's not quite as good as the real thing, you know, in terms of the little tiny randomized things that happen with analog, but it's damn close. And it really helped glue the whole thing together in this way that really made it sound like the original film, you know, even to the point that there's a certain amount of sort of wobble that tape has,
mm-hmm.
that it essentially makes it so that it's very hard to have a perfectly pure pitch. You know, digital is the same from every microsecond to the next microsecond, but the tape has a little bit of wobble to it. And we've actually found that was one of the biggest things to recreate the sound of the first Alien, because if you listen to Alien, there's, like, you know, if you hear a beep or something like that, it always wobbles a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, wah, 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 you know? And we realized that was one of the things that makes it feel the way it feels. It always sounds like everything's just a little off.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as we put some of that wobble on, which, you know, feels like it would be a bad thing, right? Like, why would you want to, you know, make it imperfect? But in a way, we've found that it's almost like film grain, where it just makes the mix and the sound kind of breathe a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And those little imperfections are actually really pleasant sounding in a funny way. And you know, more importantly, it made it sound like the original film. So that was a big thing for us when we found that approach, that, you know, that's one of the ways we can take this very modern mix, you know, fully immersive, very, you know, heavily panned film, and give it that same kind of character, at least.
Well, and what I appreciate is the fact that wobble, and your analogy to film grain is perfect, Will. It's absolutely perfect. But we're looking at this and everything is dirty. These are not pristine new ships that are flying out somewhere. Everything is old. Everything is decrepit. Be it the Corbelon taking off. Be it the mining colony that they're on. Be it the resistance that they go to. It's filthy. It's broken. You don't, I don't expect, or nor do I want to hear pristine sound with no texture to it. No wobble. I want the sound to match what I'm seeing in this world, in this environment that's been created. And you do that impeccably here. It is impeccable. Absolutely amazing.
I appreciate that. I mean, it's certainly what we were going for. You know, we were really trying to give it that, you know, very deeply textured, nothing shiny, you know, very used sounding future. And it was important for us that things did sound lived in.
And you definitely achieved that. And then you've got this great sonic rhythm going from beginning to end. Just so well done. So well done. As much, I mean, I just love your work anyway, as you know. But what the detail that you guys have brought into play with Alien Romulus and the specification with the individual sounds, just magnificent. Absolutely magnificent.
That's so sweet. Thank you.
I do have to ask you, though, with all of your hunting and buying equipment, vintage equipment, online, what was your favorite or the most wonderful piece that you got that helped you with Alien Romulus?
It was this weird old thing called a Marshall Time Modulator, and it was an early analog device. This is, you know, pre-digital. But it was right after they had come out with chips that could do analog audio delay and variable audio delay. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially it's a sort of a form of an echo box or echo creator. But if you use it with really short time and use a lot of modulation on it, you can make some very weird sounds, and that was essentially what we ended up using for recreating Ash's voice, that weird, you know, broken android mm-hmm. kind of sound. It also turns out it was used on a lot of like David Bowie records, you know, other things like that. So it was cool to, you know, play in that sandbox a little bit.
So now, is this part of your toy collection? Your personal toy collection?
It is. I mean, that's the fun thing. Is, you know, now that I've sort of learned about more of this stuff, now I have more toys to play with.
You can never have too many production toys, Will. Never.
I agree.
Never. Well, this has been so spectacular getting to speak with you again and to have you shortlisted. I would have liked to have seen Saturday Night on the short list as well. But I'll take Alien Romulus. Job so well done, Will. So well done. And I've got my fingers crossed that you make the final cut. You should.
I hope so. We'll see.
You should.
Thanks for the support.
Will, thank you so, so much. And hopefully we'll chat again next year. Unless you're not working anymore, that this year filled you up.
Maybe, and I could use a break.
Well, thank you. And you have a wonderful holiday.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.